2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM. Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Wednesday the 13th of April and this is Game On. Coming up on the show, the Ireland women stepped up to the challenge of Sweden in Gothenburg. We'll reflect on their performance with Lisa Fallon.
Here's McCabe's shot. It's deflected goal. Katie McCabe from absolutely nothing has given Ireland the lead. That's incredible stuff. There's a small band of Irish supporters in Gothenburg who are celebrating a massive deflection. They'll take that. Ireland take the lead 2 minutes before halftime. It's Sweden 0, Republic of Ireland 1.
After a night of high drama in the Champions League, we'll look back on the action, plus look ahead to tonight's games with Miguel Delaney and Paul Carey.
Here's an opportunity though. Vinicius Junior, decision time. Clips it towards Benzema! That's his moment! One off the crossbar earlier, but he was never going to miss this one. It's those two link up again. Vinicius Junior with a superb pick-up and power to the net by Karim Benzema. Real Madrid back in front.
Plus, we'll have Aisling Connolly on Camogie and Nadine Doherty on Ladies Football. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. Last night, we saw lots of Champions League drama as Chelsea's reign as European champions came to an end. They were defeated by Real Madrid in the Bernabeu. And I'm delighted to say that Miguel Delaney, who was in situ, joins us now on the line. Miguel, it was crazy scenes on the TV last night. What was it like in the stadium?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, Bernabeu, I'm actually just outside the other Madrid stadium now, Atletico Madrid, the other game. And I suppose one of the things that strikes even outside a modern stadium like this one is when you're at the Bernabeu for a night like that, for all that Madrid are as a club, it really gets rocking. I think part of it is, of course, the knowledge a stadium like that has seen so much history. So when it's building up, so like when Modric put in that pass for Rodrigo for the goal that was equaliser, there's that belief that kind of reverberates around the stadium that something big is going to happen. And invariably with Madrid, it generally does. It's very rare they get knocked out at home. There did feel a sense last night that it was almost, well, it was supposed to be two things. I would say more about Chelsea's own sloppiness and failing. And then, of course, the other side, the brilliance of particularly two players, Benzema and Modric.
Miguel, when kids are doing their leaving cert or in college and they want to be sports journalists, they think, right, I'd like to be like Miguel, heading off to these games, going to the Bernabeu and then following it up with a night and watching Atletico. But you're one of the rare ones, to be fair.
This one fell quite nicely because it's very, very rare there's two games in the same city like this. The last time actually happened in the Champions League in the knockout stages was in 2014, which was when Guardiola's Bayern Munich played Real Madrid then, and Mourinho's Chelsea played Simeone's Atletico Madrid. And of course, tonight, two of them still involved, one of the different teams. Guardiola City against Atletico Madrid. But yeah, it does. It's been a little bit of a sense of a kind of a festival of football around Madrid this week, just purely for the fact that the two games are in such close proximity, both in time and place.
Yeah, it sounds pretty amazing. Nice and glamorous. You've a glamorous old life, Miguel. Look, I'll give you that. Right, well, Paul Carey also joins us on the line, and Paul is a Chelsea fan, and no doubt, Paul, you were heartbroken watching last night.
There was some emotional scenes out in Castleknock. I was watching with my family, Marie. A bit of a roller coaster. I was nearly exhausted watching it. But from a Chelsea perspective, I think Miguel knocked the nail on the head there. I think Chelsea, you know, produced the type of display and setup that was needed for the fixture and the spectacle that was in it. So I thought they played really well. They set up perfectly. They nullified, I guess, the threat that Madrid had in that first leg when they flooded the midfield, and they looked far better set up. And I guess as a Chelsea fan, you were crying out for that early goal, and they got that through Mason Mount, a really well-worked move and a super finish. And you always felt like they were in with the chance once they pulled the first goal back. Rudiger levelling it gave you that belief, and then when Werner scored, you thought, okay, here we go, we're set up for the semi-final. I think Chelsea will reflect on this in the next couple of days and couple of weeks as one that they threw away. I thought potentially there was an opportunity to change it once they went ahead in the tie. And I thought introducing maybe the likes of a Jorginho maybe would it just solidified it? I know it's easy to say in hindsight, but I thought that probably that was a tactical change that maybe should have happened, because once they went ahead, Marie, the game was far too open. It didn't need to be. Chelsea could have killed it as a spectacle and as an event. You saw when Madrid went ahead, they were going down. Carvajal went down. Benzema went down. Alaba went down. Courtois took ages to take restarts and get the game going again. And that's what Chelsea failed to do. And a couple of individual errors. Kante for the first, giving the ball away. Unbelievable piece of skill from Modric to pick out Rodrigo for finish. And then Thiago Silva, I thought, was poor for the second goal. Firstly, the pass, and then secondly, he's got to go meet Vinicius Jr. Can't let players of that quality get their head up and deliver a ball into somebody like Benzema. And they were the moments in both boxes that probably separated the two teams. Chelsea just probably a little sloppy at times. You think back to the first leg, the goal Mendy gave away, and Real Madrid have probably capitalised on Chelsea mistakes as opposed to really opening them up, bar the Modric pass. So certainly one that they'll reflect and think, it's got away, and those last 15 minutes were pivotal over the course of the two legs.
And Lisa Fallon is with us as well. Lisa, just given the mountain that they had to climb, do you agree with Paul that it is one that Chelsea will feel that they threw away, or do you think they just made the best out of the situation that we're in and had left it a little bit too hard for them to get over the line?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it was very obvious from the first leg that they had really given themselves that mountain to climb. But, you know, I think there was, you could see from the reactions of the players and even from Thomas Tuchel in his post-match interviews last night as well, there was a real sense of regret. And probably sometimes you look back on the first leg and you go, you know, we gave ourselves too much to do. But the fact that they got themselves into a winning position in the game and then lost it from there, it makes it even harder, because they had done what was almost impossible, which was to get themselves back in the tie and give themselves a chance to win it. And like I say, to lose it from that position has to be so much tougher. And you could just see that from the players' reaction, you know, all over the pitch, and particularly Tuchel in the post-match comments. I think it's harder because they got ahead for them. I definitely think that.
Miguel, talk to us about that Luka Modric pass. You've obviously seen an awful lot of them over your time and seen some of the greatest players play the game. Where does it rank? How good was it?
I mean, the closest I can think of it was actually in terms of just a pass like that kind of going beyond the goal. Sadly, when it wasn't that, it was Kaká against Liverpool in the 2005 Champions League final. But that had an amazing finish from Crespo. This had a great finish from Rodrigo, but it was really the audacity of the fact, not just the execution, the outside of the foot and swerving it so directly into Rodrigo's path, but also the fact he spotted it in the first place. I mean, out of the corner of his vision. I mean, there's probably no one else in the stadium that saw it on rather than Modric. And I saw it, like, Casillas, the former Madrid goalkeeper, was talking after the game last night, saying any other player, even some of the best midfielders he's played with, would have gone for the simple pass right in front of him, which I think was the Benzema. And instead, Modric, because he can do that, he was able to both see and pull off what others can.
Yeah, it was, I think, one of those ones that, you know, you remember before the goals, it was that good. Talked as well about Benzema. So 34 years of age, he scored 38 goals across all competitions for Real Madrid. He seems to be having one of his best ever seasons for them. What was he like in person running around? Did he look as good as he did on TV as well?
Yeah, no, to be fair, he was still high class in this game. He was probably just a little bit quieter than the first game. I think that was partly down to this nature of the match. As Paul said there, I mean, Chelsea were in control for a lot of it. And it was almost a bit more opportunistic from Benzema. But then, of course, one of the differences with his role now compared to his role for most of the time in Madrid, whereas he used to be essentially a scurrier for Cristiano Ronaldo, a support act to the main show, now he is the main show. And if you talk to people around Madrid, people that know him, first of all, it allows him to express himself in a way he never really could before. And he's obviously got that immense talent. And secondly, he's kind of growing into his role as leader, they say. That's almost brought out more of them. And of course, yeah, it means we're not just seeing an expression of talent in terms of amazing things he's doing, but he's also scoring really decisive goals. I mean, look at his form in these Champions League knockouts alone. First player to score a hat-trick in consecutive knockout games since Ronaldo, which was another straight sort of plane he's on. But of course, with those goals coming in massive games, won a huge comeback against Paris Saint-Germain. The second, basically, to set up this win against Chelsea, and then the actual winner of the tie after we'd seen, to almost set up what was a second comeback in this tie after Chelsea. And yeah, we are probably actually talking about the best player in the world right now.
Yeah, that's quite a statement. Thomas Tuchel, afterwards, he was quite annoyed. He criticised the referee for smiling and laughing with Carlo Ancelotti. We could see him, especially towards the end of the game. He was so animated on the touchline. How annoyed was he, Miguel, at the end?
He opened up, I suppose, pointing to his team's own sloppiness. Tuchel is generally quite matter-of-fact. And again, he couldn't escape the fact he felt it was really lost in the first leg, even though Chelsea basically lost twice. Once in that game at Stamford Bridge, second in the latter stages here. He did make a point of mentioning, he was asked about the referee, but then he made a point of kind of adding this little extra about how he went over to try and congratulate Ancelotti and then saw this. And to be honest, it's not the first time we've seen that from managers in this situation. Just maybe a little bit of ungraciousness that came out of frustration, even I suppose if there was the kernel of a point there. But ultimately, to be fair to Tuchel, he was mostly looking at, as he put it, the sloppiness of his own team and two mistakes that really cost them.
Okay, Miguel, I know you have work to do, so we won't keep you too much longer. But just before we do let you go, you are going to the Wanda Metropolitano for the Atletico Manchester City game. How do you expect that one to go?
I think City should get through quite comfortably. I was at the first leg, and for all the mystique of Atletico in the last decade, as good a manager as Simeone is, they just look a level below City. Even when they've got like a real star in Joao Felix, someone that City have looked at as a potential number nine if they don't get Erling Haaland. But again, we're talking about players operating in different roles and maybe what they're best at. He's almost kind of a worker for Simeone rather than the kind of true number nine he should be. And just when it comes right down to it, as good as Simeone is the manager, as combative as Atletico are, it feels like their only real chance in this game is kind of getting into City's faces, trying to distract them in that kind of classic Atletico way, and then trying to scramble a goal from that. If it's an outright football match, it's difficult to see them just doing enough damage to City. And I think City should go through relatively comfortably. I don't think it'll be anything like the spectacle of last night, given how Atletico play. But who knows? This is a competition that has repeatedly gone against expectation that way, and has been one of the great sporting spectacles of the last decade, but arguably surpassing anything else, given the quality of players on show and some of the comebacks we've seen up the last few years. So maybe it'll be that, but to me, logic suggests a fairly comfortable City win, given their 1-0 ahead.
Okay, Miguel Delaney, thank you so much for joining us. We will talk to you soon. Paul, we will get on to the to tonight's games a little bit later on the show, but I do just want to go back to Thomas Tuchel and just how animated and emotional he was. Emotional is the word of the day. At the end of that game, just from a player's point of view, is that helpful? Is it a distraction when a manager is that vocal on the pitch?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think what you see with Tuchel, and maybe some of the question marks, particularly about his time in Paris Saint-Germain, was that it worked really well for maybe the first year or two, and then after that period of time, it becomes maybe a bit intense for players to constantly, deal with that emotion. But Thomas Tuchel as a manager seems to just want the best for his players and best for the team, and is always probably looking for that perfect performance, maybe a difficult man to please. But I think when you see the efforts from the players last night, there wasn't any sign of players not working for the manager or any sort of doubts or lingers about their commitment to the team. So I think everybody seems to be quite well aligned, maybe outside of Lukaku with Chelsea Football Club. But I think it was just a bit of a particularly around the comments around the referee, I didn't think the referee had a bad game. I think people would probably be questionable about the Alonso handball, but that's just the rules of football. Maybe he could have quickened the Real Madrid players into restarting the game a bit more, but I thought the referee was fair enough over the course of the 120 minutes. And maybe just, as you said, the emotion of the occasion getting to him. But I think Tuchel has been fantastic for Chelsea, and I can hopefully see him continuing that job and the work that he has done at the football club.
Yeah, he does seem to fit in very well, but it is probably the outside factors that will determine that. And Lisa, just while we're on managers, Ancelotti deserves a huge amount of credit as well, because I think just the job he has done with Real Madrid, and when you compare the players that they have maybe to other teams and definitely age profile, he's getting the best out of them, it seems.
Yeah, it does. And to be fair, he is a top quality manager. He's been there. He's got the T-shirt. He knows he knows how to manage big games and he knows how to manage big players. And he's also got so much experience in different environments. And, you know, I think he is... I actually remember reading his book a couple of years ago, Quiet Leadership. And he is probably much more introverted as a manager than someone like Tuchel, who is probably more extroverted. And it's really interesting when you compare that personality difference in managers, because it is different. And sometimes introverted managers don't get the limelight as much and can go under the radar, but it doesn't mean they're not as passionate about the game. It's just about how they express themselves. But I think the job that he has done... And you think about even the profile of Spanish football, you know, up until very recently, people talked about Spanish football and La Liga as being, having fallen down the pecking order in the top three, in the top five leagues in Europe. And you look at it now and it's, you know, you've got Atletico, you've got Real, you've got Barcelona, the rivalry back between those clubs. And it's just, you know, there is a bit of a rejuvenation going on in Spain at the moment. And I think Ancelotti has done a really, really impressive job.
Yeah, it's a really good point, actually, about the managers and the ones that are a little bit introverted, because you definitely don't talk about them as much. And there's some fascinating characters managing the top teams. And I think they were out in force last night. And two of them are Unai Emery and Julian Nagelsmann as well, Paul. And just the difference maybe in styles and what they've been able to get out of their teams. Obviously, Villarreal shocking everybody, Bayern Munich included to qualify for that semi-final.
Absolutely, Marie. And, you know, everybody connected with football in this country will probably relate to Unai Emery and the job that he did with Arsenal, and maybe not being overly successful during his stint there, and maybe people tarnish him as a bit of a failure. But when you look at his record outside of Arsenal Football Club, like the Europa League that he won with Sevilla, the job he's doing with Villarreal at the moment, you only have to go down through the players that were playing last night. Foyth, who's ex-Tottenham, Capoue, Francois Coquelin, Lo Celso, you had Serge Aurier on the bench. You go through their 11 players that they have, and there's no superstars within that squad. So what you do have then is just a really well-defined way of playing, great structures. They're very open in how they play, and they've knocked out some big sides along the way, and no bigger than Bayern Munich. I think even going into last night, 9 out of 10 people would have told you that Bayern Munich will still go through. The fact that Unai Emery has brought that club into the semi-final Champions League is an amazing achievement. And then on the flip side, you know, you only have to read the papers today to look at Julian Nagelsmann, and there's a lot of question marks about some of the changes that he made last night, bringing on the likes of Choupo-Moting and Gnabry don't seem to have gone down too well, and people are questioning whether or not he got it right. And it's interesting. I really like the Emery story. I think he's somebody who's always stuck to his principles. It would have been easy for him to maybe change it up after leaving Arsenal, not being too successful. But the job he's done there with Villarreal, off the back of last season to win the Europa League and now to the semi-final of the Champions League, is certainly one to be admired.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal, isn't it, Lisa? Just given the fact that there was almost surprise last year when he did go out and get so much out of his team and win the Europa League and, you know, took some big scalps along the way. But this is a whole different level.
I know it is. It is. There's no denying it. And that's the thing. Like, he's had that time with the team and with his squad. He knows exactly what he has there. And he has created a way of playing for this team that really suits the strengths of the players that he has. And players buy into that. And when you get your players to buy into something, you know, that can be a really powerful thing. And because these are players who've been rejected by bigger clubs, shall we say, or said to have not been good enough to play at certain clubs that would be perceived as being bigger clubs than Villarreal. And that's why what he's done is he's created a real momentum within the team and a real cohesive team where they play for each other and for their own cause. And it's, like I say, they fully believe in it, and that's why they're confident. They didn't go into these games fearing it. They had a quiet confidence, probably similar to the mentality of the manager, you know, that listen, everyone's talking about them, they're not giving us a chance, you know, we know where their weaknesses are, we can stay under the radar, low profile, and we can just go and do our thing. And the pressure was off them. them. All the pressure was on Bayern last night and Nagelsmann. And that's, you know, that type of pressure also is a test from a managerial perspective as well. So what he has done is phenomenal. And listen as well, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about it recently is about different managers fitting the culture and the identity of a club. And I really think this is something we're going to see more of and more focus on over the next number of years, is what is the identity of the club and what is the tradition of the club and what way does the club want to be perceived and valued and seen, you know, in the style of play. And does the manager, the potential manager, align to that? And you know, you're going to see that a bit more now, I think, where that becomes, you know, with certain levels and certain clubs, that's already a massive factor in predetermining who your shortlist is going to be. What types of substitutions do you make? You know, what backroom staff are you going to bring? What's your recruitment policy? What's your successes like when you recruit? All that type of stuff is factored in when clubs at the highest level are, you know, identifying managers and creating shortlists. But it's about picking the manager that fits the needs of the club. And that's why sometimes some players don't necessarily work out at certain clubs and they do at others. And they have, you know, they're really, really impressive at some clubs. And we've seen loads of examples of that down through the years. And even currently with, you know, the Lukaku one with Chelsea, does he fit the system? Does Chelsea's system fit Lukaku? And sometimes it is a case of putting square pegs in round holes. But that's what we're seeing. And you know, what he's done at Villarreal is he's found a club that really aligns with him. He believes in them. They believe in him. He's been given the freedom to create the squad and bring in the players and that he wanted, that could do the roles that he wants them to do. And what he's done is massively, massively impressive.
When you look at Bayern then, Paul, and just the fallout today and the headlines and, you know, just the unhappiness that there seems to be with the manager, but it is the manager, Nagelsmann, who seems to be the one that's going to be sticking around and the players are the ones that are going to be leaving.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, he's come in from Leipzig with a very high profile and a very good CV of somebody who's taken a club up through the ranks and obviously had a very good run in the Champions League going back a couple of years. It is a difficult one at Bayern Munich at times. The expectation is that you win the league every year, and I think they're 9 points clear at this moment in time in the league, Marie, and that's not enough as a Bayern Munich manager. You need to be going deep into these competitions. I think Pep Guardiola consistently got to them semi-final. They would have won the Champions League only a couple of years ago, and that is the expectations from the fans and from the board there, that they should be in the latter end of these competitions. Yeah, listen, they've been highly reliant on Lewandowski and Müller down through the years. Even the likes of Manuel Neuer, are they coming towards the tail end of their career? Probably not, but they're maybe not quite at the level. I know Lewandowski, listen, still scores you 30-40 goals a season, but maybe they're not at the level that they were in previous years. And maybe there is a case, maybe not over the next 12 months, but over the next 18-24 months, to start blooding in new players and maybe starting to look to get his own stamp and his own players in line with the way that he wants to play at that football club. But I think even at that, he'll be bitterly disappointed, even trailing 1-0 going into yesterday, particularly when they got back level. You thought they would have gone and kicked on, and maybe he will question some of his decisions, but I can't really see Bayern Munich changing it up there. I think they'll give him time. They'll give him, you know, next season and beyond probably to push this team on. He's already brought the likes of Upamecano in. The young lad, Musiala, who they've taken in from Chelsea, he's often been given a really good run in the team too. So the more players he starts to blend in, you might maybe start to see a bit more of his stamp on that side. But going well in the league, they'll tidy up that competition, they'll win that, and there'll probably be increased expectation and maybe scrutiny on his European performances next year.
Okay. Enough of the Champions League. We're going to take a very quick break and then we'll be back talking Ireland, Sweden, and we'll also discuss Kenny Shields' controversial comments.
RTE 2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
No, Well, welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. It is just coming up at 6:30. I'm delighted to say that I am still joined by Lisa Fallon and Paul Corrie. And Lisa, let's get stuck into the Republic of Ireland women's team last night and their performance against Sweden. A 1-1 draw, but I think it was the performance, the manner of the way they went out, and they fronted up against the second best team in the world and came away pretty happy, I'd say, with how it all went down.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think I spoke in the days leading up to it that, you know, there was kind of talk of it being a free hit for Ireland. And, you know, I said it on the RT Soccer podcast, like, I was just really uncomfortable with that terminology, because if we want to hit new levels and if you want to achieve something that hasn't been done before, you have to change that mindset and you have to look at every game and see, okay, where can we get a result in this game? How can we get points? Can we win this game? And if we are to win this game, where are the details in how to do it? And I think that is something that Vera and her backroom team and the players not only identified last night, but, you know, in the lead up to the game, worked on it clearly in the days leading up to the match, but also executed it really, really well. And people say that you need a bit of luck and all the rest of it, and yes, you do, but you make your own luck, and I'm a firm believer in that. And, you know, you knew that Ireland were going to have to defend for large spells in the game, which they did, and it was a big ask, because, like I said in commentary last night, the way Sweden attack you, they have just so many different ways of attacking, and they have players who recognise where spaces are. But the problem they had last night was they couldn't find the spaces, and it made it, you know, really difficult for them. And they tried different ways. We had crosses coming in, they tried central attacks, they tried to play little balls down the sides of the defenders. They tried to get in behind and cut the ball back. And Ireland were so exceptionally disciplined on the concentration levels and the communication between the players, who, like, you do not execute a performance like that if you have not really clearly worked on it, and that everybody is very, very clear about their roles. And that's what was so impressive about it. But I really picked up on something that Megan Connolly said afterwards, that, you know, Ireland knew that they would not get many chances in the game, but that they had spotted in the video reviews space that they could potentially exploit, that Sweden tended to leave. And what happened, if you think about the build-up to the goal, Ireland had intercepted the ball, they were on the counter-attack, and Magda Eriksson fouled because she knew Ireland were in a really dangerous position and that Sweden were numbers down and Ireland had numbers coming. So it's a professional foul, she got booked. But also, and it was quite high up the pitch, so it's not really, you know that ball's not going into the box, it's going to land potentially on this side of the box. But Katie McKay played wide to Megan Connolly. Now, Megan Connolly has an exceptional right-footed delivery. But what I loved about it was, why would the left centre-back be out on the wide right flank on the touchline? Number one. So that was deliberate. That was pre-planned. If we get a free kick in this area, we're going to do this. She sends in the ball. The ball breaks. Denise is holding it up and Katie makes the run, calls, and she, her quotes afterwards, she was saying she was screaming at Denise to lay the ball back to her. And she hit the strike, and obviously it takes a deflection. It was on target anyway. Probably, I still think it possibly would have gone in. And Ireland are 1-0 up. But I don't think, like, that all came from work that mm-hmm. the team had done and planned for, that if a moment like that happens, or and maybe connected a couple of things. And that was, for me, what was most impressive about it, that despite the amount of defending Ireland knew they would have to do, they also knew that when they got their moments to attack, what they were going to do, and it wouldn't have been left to chance. And for me, that was really a very impressive aspect of the game, because, you know, it's very tiring to spend such long periods without the ball. And they really did have to dig in, and they were just exceptional. It was, you know, probably not the easiest game to watch, you know, very nerve-wracking at times, but, you know, you have to be able to win in different ways, and you have to be able to find different solutions to get results across the qualifying campaign. And that's what Ireland did last night, and it was really, really impressive.
Yeah, there was a lot of pacing going on, I think, for the last 30 minutes in houses all around Ireland. Paul, to play in a game like that, so to have, as Lisa said, you're out there, you don't have the ball for long periods, you're defending all different types of attacks. How difficult is it to maintain concentration for that time and just to be able to keep doing your job?
Yeah, I think it's probably twofold, Marie. It's very taxing, one, on the body because you're being shifted from right to left on a number of different occasions with the way Sweden kept the ball and they manipulated the ball and they move you about. But mentally as well, it's very draining. And what it does take is it takes incredible organisation and communication from Brosnan. And Courtney Brosnan was superb yesterday, not only mm-hmm. with her saves, but just the way she organised the three in front of her. And then you could see between Quinn, Conley and Fahey that they were orchestrating people around them. And that takes a lot of courage and also a lot of discipline to do that for the course of 90 minutes, because there were periods yesterday and we were fully expecting that we went without the ball. But you can see the work, and Lisa picked up on it there, you know, not only looking at the performance. I'd be the first person to hold my hand up, Marie, and say I wouldn't have watched a lot of the women's national team 3-4 years ago, but I have done over the last 2-3 years in particular. And you can see not only the improvements in the performances as a team, but the individual levels have certainly ramped up significantly, and that was a testament to what we saw yesterday. I think in particular Megan Connolly and Denise O'Sullivan were instrumental in a lot of what we did, and the usual sort of quality we get from Katie McCabe. Lisa touched on it there. Not only the strike, I know it took a deflection, but I thought the way she got the ball out of her feet was superb, and the layoff from Denise O'Sullivan, there was an understanding of what sort of a ball was needed, and the whole performance from the team with and without the ball has certainly gone up a hell of a lot of levels. And you're right in the sense that, yes, it's very difficult, to particularly away from home, to hang in there. We had a bit of luck, but I think we deserved it, because the way we were organised, the way we were set up, the good work we did in particular in the first half with the ball, we deserved to come out of that fixture with a result. And listen, I have a feeling that, I was only saying it to one of the lads yesterday, that if women's football continue on the trajectory it's been on over the last 2-3 years, the possibilities are endless for women's football in this country. And you saw the crowd in the stadium that it was played in front of yesterday. There's no reason, I don't think, given from where we've come from over the last 5 years, that we can't at least look to emulate the support and the finances and the structures that the likes of Sweden have.
Yeah, Lisa, we're talking about a Finland game, and already the campaign to get it into the Aviva Stadium is starting, and I think it would be absolutely magnificent. And I think, I don't know who pointed it out, but when you look at what Barcelona were able to do in their Champions League, and even what PSG do week in, week out with the crowds that they have, you'd have to think that if you put a campaign in place that you would be able to get a serious crowd in there.
Yeah, I do. I do. And I think, you know, the one thing that is commonplace when you look at those types of crowds is the marketing campaigns that go around them to raise the awareness, because often people will go and they would make the effort. And I've no doubt that if there was a game for the women's team and that it was decided that it was going to be held in the Aviva Stadium, I've absolutely no doubt that it would sell out. And I would even go further and say there would be people looking for tickets that wouldn't get them, and that would be the case. But I think this is an interesting one, because Tallaght Stadium has become the home of the women's team. And yes, you know, they have to play Georgia away in June, and, you know, there's no foregone conclusions, but it will be expected that Ireland will win that game. And then they come into the home game against Finland, and then they've another game against Slovakia to complete the group. That Finland game is going to be absolutely pivotal. Mm-hmm. And what you want to do is to make sure that the team has the best opportunity to get the result that's needed, i.e. winning that game, as possible. And if the players felt that doing that in the Aviva with a full house would be the right way, then the FAI, I can't see why that decision wouldn't be backed. However, if the players in the group feel that they would be better off playing in Tallaght, a game, you know, a ground that they're extremely familiar with, that will sell out, that is their home, and if they feel that they would have more of an advantage by playing there, I think that level of consultation should be done, because what you wouldn't want is for it to become a massive occasion as opposed to the crucial qualifying game that it is going to be. And that for me would be the one thing, like, yes, everybody would want to see them playing in the Aviva Stadium. And I think it's only it really is only a matter of time now before that happens, because the players want it, the public want it. And I think, you know, it will happen. But having said that, I think the Finland game is a mammoth game. And I really think, regardless, wherever that game ends up being played, I think that should be, the players should have a significant input as to where that game takes place, because this is a game they have to win, and they should have the input as to where they want to play that game.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Lisa, because getting to a World Cup should take priority over everything else, because if you're talking about marketing and growing the game, the thing that will grow it the most is seeing the women's team at a major tournament. So whatever it takes should be done to make that happen. Well, let's move on now to something that takes away from the women's game, unfortunately. Paul, so yesterday, Northern Ireland boss Kenny Shields claimed that second goals in women's football come soon after the first because women are more emotional than men. So Shields was talking after his side had lost to England in Windsor Park and ended their hopes of qualifying for the Women's World Cup. Now, there was a lot of fallout after that. Kenny has since apologised for his remarks. But I think it probably has, it has drawn an awful lot of eyeballs to the women's game for the wrong reasons. But this time round, most people are saying, look, Kenny's wrong. He shouldn't have said that. And he got it wrong.
Yeah, listen, it's particularly disappointing, Marie. You know, we're talking there about whether or not the women's team should play their qualifier in the Aviva Stadium or Tallaght, because we've a really good chance of qualifying for an international tournament. And then you get a reminder of some of the education that needs to be done in society as a whole. You know, whether it's these types of comments or it's racist comments or whatever it is we're talking about, you get a reminder that there's still a lot of work to be done. I think what's irritated me and what will irritate a number of people is it seems like something that Kenny has thought about. You know, there was statistics that he put behind it, talking about the minutes of the goals and the regularity, or the, you know, how regular it's actually happened in certain instances within the women's game. And it looks as if he's come to a conclusion that that is his opinion that exists in within women's football. And it's just so wrong. You know, you look at the emotion that goes on across all sports, across male and female sports, and you see a number of different instances where mistakes happen, or there's lapses of concentration, or maybe one team is vulnerable after conceding, and then they go ahead and concede again. And that's just, it's a human nature. It's not something that is ingrained in a specific person or a specific sex of person. Like, it's just an absolutely bizarre and ridiculous comment to come out with. And particularly when you look at the work that Kenny has done there, and he's got them to a European finals, and that should be a momentous occasion for Northern Ireland. There's a major cloud, and there has to be a major cloud of doubt about whether or not he can remain in that job, particularly given, for the reasons that I've mentioned there, that this is something that he has clearly thought about and an opinion that he clearly has. And the apology seems a bit of a tick the box, because maybe somebody has been in his ear and, you know, the reaction it has had, but it certainly left a stale taste in a number of people's minds and mouths about, you know, his opinion and how that is actually related to the women's game.
Okay, well, for anyone that didn't hear them, let's play it.
If you go through the patterns, when a team concedes a goal, they concede a second one within a very short period of time, right through the whole lot, the whole spectrum of the women's game, because girls and women are more emotional than men, so they take a goal going in, they don't take that very well. So if you watch, you go through the stats, which journalists love to do, going through stats. When we went 1-0 down, we killed the game, tried to just slow it right down, because to give them time to get that emotional imbalance out of their head, and that's an issue we have, not just Northern Ireland, but all the countries have that problem. I shouldn't have told you that.
Now, Lisa Fallon, what is your reaction to those comments?
I still can't really believe them every time I hear them. I still think it's bizarre. But, you know, he's talked about stats there. And what really galled, like, I've worked a lot with statistics, as people will know, but also I know that you can find a statistic to prove any point that you want to make if you specifically want to make a point. And I'll go back to what Paul said there about, you know, that he felt that Kenny Shields had it really intended and thought about what he was saying. And I just looked back over the last week, and last week Chelsea lost to Real Madrid in Stamford Bridge, and Chelsea conceded in the 21st minute and the 24th minute. On Saturday the 2nd of April against Brentford, Chelsea conceded in the 50th minute and the 54th minute. So I was like, okay, maybe that's just Chelsea. Maybe they're just emotional at the moment because of what's going on with the club and everything. But I just stayed with Saturday and had a look at the Championship, and Nottingham Forest scored against Blackpool in the 30th minute and again in the 36th minute. They were the second and third goals. In League One, Accrington Stanley played against Cheltenham. Cheltenham conceded in the... They were 1-0 up and they conceded in the first minute of injury time at the end of the first half, and again in the fifth minute of injury time at the end of the first half. And in League Two, Walsall conceded two goals in quick succession against Leighton Orient in the 10th and the 16th minute. So, first of all, to come out and say something like that and to say that the statistics are there to back them up, is, you really want to give the statistics if you're going to say something like that. But the bigger point here, and I think it's very damaging to the women's game, and to have someone of his stature to reinforce prehistoric biases that have oftentimes been deliberately put out there against women or against people in society. And, you know, you see it all the time. If a woman is vocal or animated, I think we've heard earlier, used earlier by Miguel in describing a manager on the touchline, if a woman does that, she's trying too hard, or she's out of control, or she's, you know, emotional, seeing as that's the word that's being used at the moment. And we really have to think about the power of words and how we use them. Because the way that a word is used to describe a man is sometimes different to the way it is used to describe a woman doing the same thing. And that comes down to those biases that have been normalised in our society, and we really have to, Paul is right, we really have to continue to work as a society to make sure that we change those biases, and that, you know, that the language used to describe a person, a woman doing an action, is the same or similar language is used to describe a man doing the same thing. And it's really important that, you know, we particularly in sports commentating and even in sports reporting, you become very conscious of that in the terminology that you use, and rightly so. And even, you know, when you look back at sometimes a number of years ago, the imagery, the photography that was used to show women in sport was very different to the angles or perhaps the shot choices that were used for men's, to reflect men's sport. And it is something that there is a lot of work that has to be done, particularly when we call for this extra visibility. And I just think that it was right for him to apologise, but I'm not sure that an apology can really cover the damage that those comments have done, particularly from somebody in his stature as a senior international women's team manager who is taking his team to the Euros this summer. It's very, very disappointing, and you really would expect more and better from somebody in that position.
Yeah, really well said, Lisa, that's for sure. Okay, we are going to take a very, very quick break. Lisa and Paul, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back. Ladies football and Camogie after these.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. A little bit of breaking news. Cork GAA have confirmed that Keith Ricken is stepping away from his managerial role as the Cork senior football manager. Due to health reasons, John Cleary is filling in as the interim manager, and Cork GAA wish Keith a speedy recovery and look forward to seeing him back on the sideline, as I'm sure everybody does in the GAA and sporting world. Now, over the weekend, Meath were crowned Division 1 champions in the Ladies Football Little National Leagues. I caught up with Nadine Doherty to talk about the game, and I started by asking her how disappointed she was that her Donegal couldn't get over the line.
Yeah, I'm really, it's the first time I've cried after a game of football in a long time. You know, Donegal, those girls, they must be thinking what they have to do to get over the line. I said, yeah, it was a great game of football end to end. And we kind of thought, geez, after the first quarter, Donegal were really out of it. But credit to Meath, look, as you said, they probably haven't found themselves under that pressure while trying to maintain a lead in a while. You know, I felt they were under more pressure there on Sunday than they were in the All-Ireland final against Dublin in those last 5 minutes. I wouldn't have said they were by far the better team on the day, but I suppose, look, they probably executed that defensive game plan to a standard whereby Donegal were just put under huge pressure when trying to execute their scoring chances. And that, along with, I suppose, Meath got two crucial scores at crucial times in that second half. And that was probably the difference, you know, over the hour.
That opening quarter, though, I mean, I looked at it and was thinking, right, well, that's it. Game over now. Donegal aren't going to be able to get back into this. But they were able to get back into it, which was impressive in itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, I suppose they do have this massive self-belief, which was evident against Dublin, obviously in the semi-final. But, you know, that first quarter to forget for them. And I think Rasha, not singling out anybody, but Rasha, you know, in goals herself, she'd be disappointed. You know, just that first quarter, her mistakes, they gifted Meath 4 out of their first 5 points, really. And, you know, Niamh O'Sullivan were very lucky. She tried to lob her and that went over the bar. And they only won 6 out of 11, I think, of their own kickouts in that first quarter. But look, credit to them, they just came to life. The penalty, Yvonne, you know, swapped the ball over and back in the hand a little bit. I thought that might have been blown for over carry. But look, it was a penalty. It was a foul. And what an execution by Niamh McLachlan. You're not going to see a better penalty than that in Croke Park this year. And that just gave them that drive, that momentum. Bit of genius from Geraldine and all the old gang, Karen Guthrie. They just got into that flow. And you were kind of thinking halftime came at the wrong time. For Donegal, and with Mary-Kate Lynch being sin-binned as well, you know, it just gave them that extra bit. But they came out in that second half, very clear game plan, very controlled. I thought Donegal, that's what I really liked about them, and Niamh McLachlan especially, she just controlled that middle third. And I thought there's a massive upset in the cards here. And then, as I said, they got those scores. Like Niamh O'Sullivan's score kind of came out of nowhere. And, you know, Niamh hasn't been playing that well this year. So it just shows the calibre of a player that she is. What a finish. Like, what a finish. And then Vicky's point. 5 minutes to go, put two between them. It just meant that Donegal had to go searching for that goal. And that already packed Meath defence. They were able to pack it even further. And it was just really hard for Donegal to get through it, trying as much as they did.
Meath have just perfected their game plan now, really, and it feels even, I guess, look, they've been doing it for quite a while now, but they're doing it at a different level and it's improving all the time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they're super defensive, Marie, I feel, and I think it has to be said, like, they're very nice to watch because they transition so quickly on that break. But Meath kicked the ball twice in the first half. Like, that's a huge stat, and that they suck the life out of teams, and they really, really slow the game down. They have it perfected. And I think teams are nearly afraid, and Donegal did it in fairness to them, but other teams are afraid to commit players to the attack. And then that allows me to have that swift transition where if teams start pushing up on them, putting them under pressure in that zonal defence, you know, in attack and bringing more pace to it. And I think a big key for Donegal in that second half when Niamh Hegarty came on, brilliant to see Niamh back. They started kicking the ball. And I think that's where teams are going to get through Meath this year. If they start kicking the ball in that quick transition from their own defence to attack, but a very, very hard defence to get through. And as you said, like, it's just improving all the time.
Yeah. And I guess what's added to that and what complements that defence is then they have the runners as well that can go with the ball and get scores. So, I mean,
yeah.
You can pack it all you want if you have someone that can break that line.
100%. Like, they're playing to their own strengths. And their goal, their second goal, epitomised how classy they are. It was a kick out from Monica McGurk, and I think three passes later, and Kelsey Nesbitt was on the end of the ball and in the back of the net. Like, that's incredible stuff in Croke Park. I'd say the transition from that, from Monica's kick out to the goal, was less than 10 seconds. And I mean, not many teams are doing that at the minute in any code, actually.
So what does all this say about the championship then?
Well, it puts Donegal in the top four, which is fantastic. They'd be very, very disappointed, obviously, because I felt they were the architects of their own downfall yesterday at times. It keeps Meath at the top. They've been saying all season that they're not a one-hit wonder and they want to show other teams that. They want to prove that. They've proven that. They didn't even need to win that league final to prove that. And we're going to have Dublin, Cork, Meath, or not Meath, sorry, Mayo, fighting at the heels. And then the Division 2 final. I was very disappointed with Armagh, actually. They'll be disappointed with themselves. And Kerry, in fairness to Kerry, massive performance in Croke Park. And I think I mentioned to Kayleigh Cronin, their fullback, what a player, what a player. And Danielle O'Leary, come on. So Kerry might have a bit of a say, but an exciting championship, Marie, definitely, definitely.
Yeah, there's plenty to look forward to, for sure. Nadine, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a million, Marie.
Now, unfortunately, we have run out of time, so we will not get to Aisling Connolly today, but we'll be chatting her to her tomorrow about the Camogie League Finals and also looking ahead to the weekend of Hurling Championship action. Thanks to John Farrell, who was producing today. We will be back tomorrow. Tara Kumar is up next.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.